everybody. Welcome back. Episode 13 of the Strength Academy podcast. It's Grayson here with Mundo.
What's up, y'all?
And we're going to kind of have a little bit of a fun topic today. Mundo and I have both done a good amount of programming for ourselves over the years, trying a lot of different things. I think that's a lot of what, you know, enables us to make good programs as coaches, is trying out some new stuff and, you know, seeing how it works. And sometimes those things don't work out the way that you want them to, or end up being very different in reality than they look on paper. So what we're going to talk about today is we're going to talk about the worst things we've ever made ourselves do.
Yeah. So for weightlifting, one of the worst things I've probably ever done is two-a-day programs when I was a beginner.
Right? Oh, yeah, that's a problem.
I was like, oh, well, the more I do, the better I'll get, right? That more is better philosophy. I had not really had the experience to know what it took to recover and to be able to adjust things accordingly based on, you know, what my level was of being able to handle volume and percentages and things like that. So what I did is I combined two programs. So I would do two-a-days, and one was with the CrossFit weightlifting program that the Bergners developed.
Okay.
And then the second was a Catalyst program. And I wrecked my body doing that, and they were both like 8-week programs, but by the end of it, I was pretty wrecked.
That's pretty brutal. So that was like two squat programs running simultaneously. Yes. Like one in the morning, one at night.
Yeah.
Oh, that's horrible. So for those of you guys who consider doing two-a-day training, the best way, one, you don't want to do it before you need to. So that's one thing. You know, you can get by doing 3, 4, 5 days for years and not need to go to 2-a-days. But when you do, and if you do need to split up your workouts, like say you're really short on time, ideally you want to do the same amount of work that you would do in one workout split up into two workouts. So did you make it all the way through 8 weeks of that?
I did. And, well, the thing is, you know, I was a bit younger. Like, I was in my early 30s. So my resolve to finish what I had started was pretty good. But at the end of it, I didn't make as much progress as I thought I would. And so I kind of figured that I had taken on too much, and the lack of progress was a result of my inability to recover, and then the programs having conflicting endpoints as far as like peaking for the cycle.
Oh.
So it kind of just it kind of ruined the whole thing. But it was a good experience because now I know I'm never going to do that again, and I won't do that to somebody else. If I design a program where, you know, there's going to be two-a-day workouts or something that can be broken up, it's going to be things that complement each other, and it has the same end goal throughout the program cycle.
Yeah, that's a valuable lesson learned. Yeah. Doubling up things. I remember trying to run like 5 CrossFit workouts a week on top of a 5-day-a-week Catalyst cycle and not reducing volume in either of them, and it gets rough. Yeah. is a way to put it. Some of the worst stuff that I did to myself was before I had really, it was kind of in my in-between phase between not really wanting to CrossFit anymore, but not knowing which of the strength sports really kept my interest. So I would just go in and lift heavy and do gnarly stuff. And I made it my intent, I was about 170 pounds, and I need to move up to like 185 pounds. How am I going to do this? So I found a program, and it was a program from, I think, the 1940s, and it's called the Squats and Milk Routine.
Okay.
So squats and milk is the first step of the program is you drink a gallon of whole milk every single day. So every day you drink a gallon of whole milk on top of your regular meals. So, and you do that without fail. So every day you have to finish the gallon. So my fridge is just full of gallons of milk. Yeah. I'm buying like six at a time. I was in college at the time, so it's a really cheap way to bulk, though. So if you're looking to move up weight and you don't mind getting a little bit fluffy, you can just crush whole milk and fart everyone out of the room, but you will put on some size because milk makes mammals grow. So that's element one. Element two involves doing 20 rep sets in the back squat. So on day one, you start with 60% of your max, and you're going to squat 3 days a week. You do one set of 20. Then the next, so on Monday, on Wednesday, you go up 5 pounds, do another set of 20. On Friday, up 5 pounds, another set of 20. And you run that as a straight linear progression of 20 rep back squats, going up 5 pounds 3 days a week.
Oh, wow.
When you finish your set of back squats, well, while you're squatting, you're supposed to be breathing as deep as you can to, like, expand and contract your rib cage to make you wider. Because this is like a 40s bodybuilding program where you just like, get a barrel chest.
That's right.
So you're taking these deep breaths, and it's taken 2.5 minutes, 3 minutes to do those squats. Immediately when you rack the bar, you lay down and do heavy barbell pullovers on a bench where you lower the weight down behind you and pull it back up as you take a deep breath. So your ribs are, your like intercostal muscles are sore, your lats are getting worked, and then you finish up with some high rep kettlebell presses. And I survived about 3 weeks. So slamming the milk, the squats are just getting harder and harder and harder. And I remember the day that I knew I was done was I did 275 pounds for 20 reps, and it was something like 75% of my max or something like that. Something just ridiculous.
Right.
And I racked the bar, my traps cramp, and I had a headache for like 2 to 3 days, and the rest of the week, if I like strained at all, I would just get this crushing headache because I had given myself like such a bad tension headache that I had like strained all the insertions on the back of my skull. But I put on 12 pounds in 3 weeks.
Oh, wow. Okay. So,
yeah, so did it work? Yeah. Was it ideal? No. It was just torture.
Yeah. That's a lot. Like, it's just the gallon of milk a day. It would be kind of gross.
GOMAD is a tried and true, we'll call it Riptovian. Method for weight gain. And the thinking being, you know, if you want to be big, you have to just get there. So if you're, you know, it's kind of, you know, a smaller person and you're looking to move up a weight class, there's a lot of different ways you can structure a diet, and some are more ideal than others. Right. But sometimes simple and cheap is better. And if you can get through a gallon of milk a day, you will start to grow. And you can worry about having abs later is kind of his reasoning behind it. But yeah, so that was one of the worst ones.
Yeah, that old school bodybuilding stuff is... It does have its place because that's how they used to do it, and it was effective.
And you know that they weren't on drugs in, like, the 30s and 40s.
Right, because they just weren't developed.
Yeah, well, I think...
Or they might have been, they just weren't as well-developed as they are
in
modern, recent times, so...
I think synthesized testosterone was World War II, if I'm not mistaken.
I think so,
So that's why I think, like... the old physical culture stuff where, you know, you look back at like early bodybuilding or like the early days of weightlifting where there were 5 lifts and a bodybuilding competition afterward. So you'd have one hand snatch, one hand clean and jerk, clean and press, clean and jerk and snatch. And then afterwards, everyone takes off their singlet and poses. And then your weight, so like the competition is not just the lifts. And it's kind of cool that it all came from that early strongman kind of influenced and evolved into like what it is now, where there's so many different strength sports, but they all kind of used to be the same thing.
Yeah. It's just like the Army Air Corps. You know, yeah. They used to be connected, and then they went off in their separate ways. So now we have bodybuilding, we have weightlifting, powerlifting, aesthetics, like the...
Yeah.
Those types of shows, too. But they all originated from one type of competition.
Yeah, because, I mean, that was, like, the early days of weightlifting competition kind of... the reason we ended up with standardized lifts is that there were a variety of traveling strongmen basically in circuses, and they were, or they, you know, they book theaters and kind of do like shows.
Right.
Right. And that's why, you know, pro strongman, they still call the competition a show. But they would travel around and then they'd get into these pissing contests about who's stronger, but they were all doing different stuff. So if two strongmen were going to have a showdown, they would agree a few months in advance on what lifts they were going to contest.
Okay.
But, you know, that was just for one-off competitions here and there. And then as, you know, interest in watching them not just show off, because like an old-time strongman show was like a little bit of lifting, a little bit of muscle control and flexing, and a little bit of like strength feats. I think, I don't remember if it was Eugene Sandow or another of the British strongmen, but he had a trick where he would lock his arm and they'd get a pony on stage with a harness on the side.
Okay.
And he would get underneath it. It would be like on a platform. And he'd get underneath it with his arm locked. And then he'd push into it and they'd move the platform and he'd support a horse. What? On one arm.
Wow.
Just, wow. I mean, he didn't lift the horse, right, but right. He stood there with it.
Yeah.
He was, and it's like, so... It. You know, as it moved from, like, crazy tricks, like, it's, like, kind of, like, part magic show, yeah. Part bodybuilding, to more competition, they had to agree on, okay, well, what, if we're going to have a lifting competition, what are we going to lift?
Right.
And, you know, the invention of, you know, the adjustable barbell, originally with lead shot loaded into the balls, mm-hmm. and then the plates kind of came a lot later.
Oh, but, okay. We actually have an athlete in our gym who, she's been training as a weightlifter recently, but she's also a bodybuilder and a competitive, like a bikini competitor.
Yeah.
And she has been really good about, sticking to her diet and also continuing to train in addition to preparing for that bikini competition. So now she's strong, but she's also very lean.
Yeah.
So I've been impressed with her dedication to completing both of those at the same time.
And that's been a really interesting thing for me because I, you know, I don't have a lot of experience with people that have done a lot of, you know, figure competition stuff. But I find it really fascinating. So getting to pick her brain and kind of be like, hey, where are you at in your cut? What are you doing outside of this training? And then looking at, well, okay, if you're going to be trying to get that lean... How are we going to adjust what we're doing to keep your technique sharp,
right.
But make sure that we're, you know, cutting for a figure competition is probably not the time to push for a PR in a strength lift. It's trying to maintain muscle mass, keep some technique going.
Right.
But, so it's been kind of fun working with her to kind of like, okay, how are we going to adjust things to make sure that, you know, you're staying safe and healthy as you get through that show.
Yeah. And it kind of ties in because, you know, she's doing these two things at once, but we're making adjustments to make sure that she stays healthy and that, you know, she continues to make progress in both realms. So when people, they adopt training programs, sometimes it's just more fun to max out and try, you know, to do heavy lifts. You know, they look better for Instagram, you
yep.
know, hitting that PR feels really good, but it doesn't take the long term into view. And I think that's where people kind of, make the mistake about jumping onto bandwagon programs on the internet and things like that.
Yeah.
And the thing is, like, when you don't have a coach and you're just following a program, like, let's say, I'm not going to mention any specific gym, but let's say a gym has programming that they offer to everybody, right? And you just pay whatever for the program. And so that program's not going to address any specific weaknesses that you have. And it's not going to enhance any of the strengths that you already have. So I think it kind of limits the amount of progress that you can make. Not that, that you won't make any progress, but you might be able to make progress faster or, you know, become a better lifter if you have somebody actually coaching you and providing you with feedback. So like in our current program, in the first 4 or 5 weeks, we've all been doing the same thing. But as the training program progresses, we're going to start branching off into where people have individual training days and working on specific things that, that are going to help them. So for some people, they can't handle volume very well. I know we did a Russian squat program where like half the people kind of just like they were having a hard time with it. And it's not that the program wasn't well developed. It was. It's just that some people's ability to recover, because as Americans, we have jobs, we have responsibilities. You know, we don't always take care of ourselves the way we should when it comes to our diet and sleep habits. And Grayson wrote an article about routine, and a lot of people don't have a set routine that they have, because if they don't have a specific thing that they're competing for, a lot of the time, like, they let their routine slack, especially on the weekends. And so I'm kind of the same way too. And when you have a program that's hard, like a squat, like a Russian squat program, or even, I'm not an advocate for Shmolov, but I've done a Shmolov program and I didn't finish it. I did like the first 3 weeks and it was like downhill from there. So it's just people's ability to recover from things or handle volume is different. And sometimes adjustments have to be made because of those types of things.
Yeah, I think so. That Russian program is a good example. That's the, you know, six doubles, and then you build up to doing like six sets of six at 80%. It was a really good example of not everybody responds the same way to things, and also like, I like to do maybe like one really gross squat program a year for everybody, just because it's kind of fun.
Yeah.
Like I think doing kind of brutal squatting is fun. Hence the amount of time I put into that 20 rep set scheme.
Right.
But I think that an important lesson learned on that one is if we were going to do that again, instead of using 100% of their actual best squat, I would have them use a training max and use 90% for all the percentages, and then that program would become survivable.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what I'm saying. Like, so for our current squat program, we're doing the hatch cycle, which is a tried and tested program. Like I've done a variation of it before and I like it. But what Grayson came up with was instead of working off your true one or a max, you drop to 90% of it. And even then, for some people, they struggle a little bit. Yeah, it's very difficult. But I think that approach has kept people more healthy. We've also kind of discouraged people using what I refer to as crutches, but like training aids, like, you know, straps and knee wraps and things like that. And people are still continuing to squat well. And you'd be surprised what you can get away with not using. Sometimes it's just like that safety blanket type thing. And people are actually doing just as well as if, you know, when they're not using them.
Yeah, it's been really cool to see, you know, as it gets harder every week, you know, sometimes, you know, people are having to throw a belt on for a final set or something like that. But doing a good amount of beltless training, you're going to strengthen your core more. Yeah. You're going to get more, you know, strength in your low back and your abs from squatting without a belt. And when it comes time to be really... Basically, and how is that not going to help your snatch? Most people don't belt up when they snatch. You know, you need to have the trunk strong, and you need to have the trunk in the right posture. So by doing the 90% and not using a belt, you're able to stay more upright because you're not using a true one rep max. So you're getting good quality reps in, and not wearing a belt, you're getting a lot stronger in that position. So I'm kind of excited to see. Everybody's looking pretty good.
Yeah.
We're finally getting back to some heavier lifting, and it's looking solid. So it's going to be a pretty fun rest of the cycle.
Yeah, I'm enjoying it. I've been having a good time with what we've been going with as far as, you know, programming exercises and all that. one of the worst programs I've done that wasn't actually barbell related though, while I was still continuing to train with weightlifting, it was just like a supplemental program, was this ab program designed by Tia Claire Toomey from the CrossFit Games.
Oh my God. I remember like when you and Robin weeks. Were doing that. That was horrible.
I lasted like 2 weeks and I was like, nope. All my lifts went to, you know, hell. I could barely, you know, maintain that core stability because it was just so wrecked. Like it was hard to maintain the intensity of that program and then do weightlifting. I just couldn't keep it together.
Well, see, here's the other thing though. You don't need that much abdominal training. Like, so there's a video that Mike Isratel made, because have you watched any of his like hypertrophy training guides?
No.
He has like, you know, well, he's a bodybuilder, so he's talking about, you know, how many sets per week and what volume can each body part handle as you're building like a bodybuilding routine. And when he talked about abdominal training, he was like, well, if you want to maintain the strength of your abdominals, you maintenance volume is basically just squat and deadlift, and they're going to stay strong enough. If you need to increase the strength, you really just need like 3 or 4 sets a couple times a week. You're going to get better at it. Like, you don't need to like kill yourself with doing an hour of abs, because the results you're going to get might actually be lower than if you just did a couple of strict leg raises a couple days a week and actually, you know, recovered. Because if you're blowing your abs up to where you can't sneeze without cramping and falling on the ground, that it's no balance.
Yeah, no, it's definitely something that you can overwork. And I've done that before, where if you're doing abs every day, it should be minimal, like volume.
Yeah.
Maybe two sets of something simple, sit-ups. I like to do leg raises and V-ups and Russian twists. And you don't have to do a whole bunch of them. But I remember one time I was doing more than I probably should have, and it was probably from that program. But I got done with an exercise, and my ab was flexing itself. Like, it was cramping and flexing itself, and I couldn't stop it. I just had to lay there and wait for it to stop. And so it was just, I was like, this is it. This is how everything ends. This is cramp crap. I can't stand up.
I'm going to bleed out of this abdominal cramp.
Yeah, so
Do you think about like doing more kind of like movement training for abs? So like, I really like dead bugs and straight leg toe touches and, you know, like floating tabletop kind of stuff, planking, like kind of moving in a plank. I think all of those things, like, I like that stuff better than just sit-ups. Sit-ups are great, like, do them a couple times, you know, get them in. They're fun. They're easy and you can get them done quick.
Yeah.
But I think that the more kind of integrative dead bug, straight leg toe touch, things that require you to like move and be flexible within your abdominal training.
Yeah.
I think they carry over a little bit better to like coordinating movement. Because when you're doing something like a dead bug, you're having to brace and stabilize the spine as opposed to just crunching or sitting up, right, which trains your like rectus abdominis, but it doesn't teach you. I like doing the ab training that teaches you how to brace as well, because then you're killing two birds with one stone.
Yeah, no, I actually do prefer ab exercises that incorporate more than just the abdominal muscles. Like you're saying, you have to incorporate balance with some of them, being able to brace correctly. And so I love planks. Side planks are very good. We don't get a lot of lateral rotation with a lot of our movements. And I think doing those side planks are important. Twists.
Oh, yeah. But Pavel press?
Pavel press is a good one.
Yeah.
But yeah, like bird dogs, dead bugs.
So hard.
Yeah. So like those are all really good exercises because they do help you to get more bodily awareness in bracing that core area, but they're also working those muscle groups. So killing the two birds with one stone is definitely something that they do.
Yeah. And I think it's, you know, people forget that, you know, when they think, well, I think maybe the problem is calling it abdominal training, because that makes you really just focus on, like, the six-pack muscles.
Yeah.
But if you're doing core training, the core is everything between your hips and your neck.
Right.
So you got to be able to stabilize and move all of that stuff. And I think that, like, the most neglected, you know, muscle group in the trunk is the intercostals, those, like, muscles between your ribs. Because those are so important for supporting the jerk.
Yeah.
If those get too tight, you can pull a rib out of place just yeah. with your own muscles with being tight. Fun.
Yeah.
So making sure that you're doing some of that, like, side bending, kettlebell windmills, like, just moving your rib cage and making sure that you're not just locked up, definitely helps with the recovery. Like, and just everybody should want to be more flexible.
Yeah, I think so too. That, like, why would you not want to be flexible? I mean, it's your ability to continue to keep your range of motion into your older years, is just making your quality of life better. I mean, how many people do you know that they're just hobbling around? You know, they have a hard time sitting up straight or getting out of bed just because they're just so immobile.
If you have to sit down to tie your shoes, you should start doing something now.
Yeah.
You know?
For sure.
Like,
you know, one of the ways that I developed my ability to squat low was just doing things in a squat. So, like, I used to brush my teeth in a squat instead of if I was going to be doing something like reading just for a short amount of time, not for an extended amount of time, but like a short amount of time, reading an article or something, I would sit in a squat and read just to get my body used to being down in that low position. And, like, over time, your body just wants to start adapting to it because you're doing it so often. So, and it goes back to, like, putting your body in positions that you want to be in. So for people that have limited flexibility and things like that, if you just spend a couple minutes just sitting in that squat and just do it every day, even if it's just for a little bit, your body's going to start adapting to it and stretching to try to reach those positions just because you're in them more often.
Yeah, and if you really struggle to, like, actually sit to full depth in an air squat for a couple of minutes, put your back against the wall and slide down, you know, scale it down. And just, you know, well, I think your example of brushing your teeth in the squat is a good example of how little things that will seem crazy to people can really make a big difference in your training.
Right.
So, like, if you know you have a problem balancing on one leg, do a bunch of stuff balancing on one leg. If you need to stop in a parking lot and stretch your hamstrings for a little bit, do it. Yeah. Like, you know, just every, like, set a timer on your phone. Every 35 minutes, I'm going to do 30 seconds on each leg for a hamstring stretch.
There you go. While you're meal prepping, standing in front of the stove cooking, balance on one foot. You know, create some bodily awareness. I mean, you
can stand in your split jerk.
Yeah.
While you, like, read the paper.
Yeah.
You know, you can incorporate all kinds of weird little neurotic habits that will actually improve your training.
Yeah, clench your butt cheeks as hard as you can during your wait in that Starbucks line for your coffee.
Yeah, I do that occasionally. I'll see if I can maintain a solid clench all the way to Santa Fe when I'm driving.
That's a bit.
It was. I only did that once. You're really hard. Yeah, it was not good.
You're like, I'm gonna crash. This thing's going. Yeah, but so, like, for training programs, I think those were probably the hardest ones that I've ever done. And it wasn't because they were difficult. I made them difficult by rearranging them in a way that they weren't meant to be done in. And so that's usually where people make the mistake of, like, not following programs and doing extra stuff. Usually doesn't benefit you as much, and then you end up with injuries and things like that. And I don't know a lot of weightlifters that do both CrossFit and weightlifting. There's some, and there's always exceptions, but most people that do weightlifting are just dedicated to weightlifting, and then people that do CrossFit supplement their CrossFit with some weightlifting training. So 'cause doing both is very difficult.
And I think that, you know, it's important to make a distinction between doing, like, traditional CrossFit and, like, doing a CrossFit class setting.
Right.
Versus doing... Because I do think that circuit training is good for weightlifting.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, do box jumps and some dumbbell clean and press and, you know, put a couple of things together, pull up, push up,
yeah.
You know, do a superset. Or, you know, if you do two movements back to back three times, you can call that CrossFit if you want.
Yeah.
But it's just, you know, a circuit.
It's just a fancy word for circuit training.
Yeah, it's just redefining circuit training. So it's important to, you know, condition the joints and all that, but the intensity just needs to be less. It's right. Like, you know, get your heart rate up, but I don't need you to redline doing dumbbell clean and jerks and sit-ups. Right. You know, that's not what we're after.
Yeah, and one thing that I've enjoyed about the past couple of weeks with some of the stuff that have been on the in between the heavy days is like push-ups and pull-ups. I've enjoyed doing the box jumps. I like those dynamic exercises that generate power and bodily control. And those have all been really good for me. Like, I've noticed in the past couple weeks that my ability to generate power, especially like in the box jump, has increased. And then, like I said, the push-ups and pull-ups, like, that's just the traditional bodybuilding exercises. And everybody should be doing them, I think. Because, like... your upper body muscular development is going to be much better if you can do 10 bodyweight push-ups and bodyweight pull-ups than if you're not doing them. Because I think a good indicator of upper body strength is how many strict pull-ups you can do. And I'm not, like, kipping is not a thing. Like, that's just a CrossFit thing, or that's, like, something that's designed.
Well, it's if you need to do it fast.
Yeah.
Right? It's a different purpose.
Right.
You know, if you need to do 50 reps... as fast as you can, if that's the name of the game, you need to play that game.
Right, but why? But if the name of the game is
developing your back strength, and it's not like a competition,
right?
Then that should be your primary goal. Because, and that's why we broke the rings out, so we've got ring rows for people that are developing their way towards that pull up. But for almost everybody, you know, I have the goal of, like, getting you to be able to do a strict pull up. Is important to me,
yeah.
Because if you can't pull yourself up, snatching your own body weight's going to be pretty hard.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, you know, it's that correlate where if you're trying to clean and jerk 1.5 body weight, but you have a hard time doing 10 push-ups, it's going to go worse. Yeah. It's not going to go as well as it could.
Yeah, I agree. I think, though, that you can go overboard with accessory exercises, too. Like, it goes back to that abdominal program, right? There's that you can do too much. More is not better all the time.
Yep.
So the way Grayson programs it, I like it. It's because it's strength building work. It's that bodybuilding work, but it's supplemental to the things we're already doing. So it's not it doesn't interfere with. You know, the Olympic lifts, it just transfers over.
Yeah, it's just, and it's as simple as just 2 to 3 sets of something. And what's like the bodybuilding mantra? Stimulate, don't annihilate.
Stimulate, don't annihilate. Ooh, we're going to make that into a t-shirt. Hey, don't take that idea, right? But yeah, no, it is an old bodybuilding adage, though.
Yeah.
Stimulate, not annihilate. And that's why people have, especially in the bodybuilding community, they have those... you know, back and buys, chest and tries, because you're not destroying those body parts all the time throughout the week. You're just doing separate exercises, isolating muscle groups, and then continuing to build on that every week with high repetitions and low sets.
Yeah, and I mean, there is, like, differences within bodybuilders, because some people do, like, Dorian Yates would yeah. just hammer something to death and then not train it again for, like, 6 days.
Yeah.
So, like, there are different things, but for athletes, you know, I think I like the, you know, get enough that it's got some stimulus to grow and get a little bit stronger, but keep your focus on, you know, you shouldn't be cripplingly sore all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think those are pretty much, like, the worst ones that I've done. Did you want to add on anything else to that?
No, I think that it's fun to do crazy stuff sometimes, but if you have... But the times I've done the craziest stuff is when I didn't have a goal.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And I wasn't really working towards something. So, you know, fun things like that, sure.
Boredom programming?
Yeah, boredom programming.
yeah, that's probably not the best thing.
Let's see, where are we at on time today?
We are at 35.
35? Oh, okay, we got plenty of time. In there? Yeah, so I've been thinking this week... there was a couple of news stories I saw that they were looking at self-ratings of happiness, and they compared people who had recently won the lottery to people with a terminal cancer diagnosis. And on average, the person dying was happier than the person that just won the lottery. Lottery winners are miserable.
Yeah.
And it kind of got me, you know, thinking like, okay, well, what do we really need? Right?
Yeah.
So how much do you need that there's a point of diminishing returns where having any more stuff isn't going to make you feel any better? And I feel like I have too much stuff. Go through these phases of I just want to throw out almost everything and like downsize my house to like where I just have the bare essentials. Yeah. Because I often wonder like, what are we missing out on when we're just padding ourselves with comfort? And like, is the pursuit of like buying a lot of stuff just a distraction for us? Like, what are we avoiding by trying to focus on, oh, do I have a new TV or I bought these 6 DVDs? Yeah. What are we trying to distract ourselves from, and what are we missing out on by trying to make ourselves comfortable all the time?
So I'm gonna address some of the like.
Yeah, that was all over the place.
It was a bit. So let me rein it in a little bit. So first of all, the lottery winner thing. And it's been traditionally shown that people that win the lottery, they do end up being more miserable. Like the reason is because they carry over the same habits that they had before they won to afterward, you know, after they have a lot of money. So if they're already, you know, in debt because they bought a Yukon and can't put gas in it, you know, and, you know, they're living paycheck to paycheck, the only difference is having more money to do the same thing. So, like, now they're going to have a $3 million house and a Lamborghini, but then they forget, oh, I have property taxes. Oh, I have to pay this, on yep. this, all this. So they end up carrying over those same habits, and they didn't learn anything as far as, like, how to manage their money. You know, they'll lend money to friends, or they'll give it, you know, to this.
That's a big thing, is family and friends coming up and like, hey, man.
Hey, your cousin Joe all of a sudden, you know, shows up and he's like, hey, remember that time I let you borrow my bike in like third grade? Like, can I borrow $1 million? Like, no, you're my scummy uncle and I don't want to have anything to do with you. But yeah, so like, yeah, people will show up out of the woodwork, and then everybody's trying to be your friend, you know, because you have a lot of money, and, you know, they're like, hey, I have this business idea. We're going to, you know, build boats and then sink them out in the Atlantic and claim insurance fraud, you know, that type of thing. So, but yeah, so like, I think the idea is that people that have, like a 60,000-ish income in the United States, you're considered like top 1% of the world.
Yep.
As far as like, you know, money and things like that. So, and then it's been shown that anything above that, it doesn't really change your level of happiness. And then it goes in the opposite way. Is like the people that have less because they don't want that are also happier. So like it really depends on like your like what you want. And we were talking about this the other day, where if your expectations exceed or they're not based in reality, the less happy you're gonna be. So the key to happiness is like low expectations and not wanting a whole lot. So you trying to get rid of stuff or not wanting things, I think it leads to a happier outlook. Because if you don't have something that you don't want, there's nothing to be upset about.
Yeah. Right?
So I think that maybe adjusting, it's easier to adjust your attitude toward what you want than it is to try to strive for getting something that's going to be very difficult or unrealistic to get. Okay, so that's that lottery coverage. Yeah. So that's my take on that. And the other thing was, I think that when people, when they want things, it, like, let's say a TV, right? Do you need a 60-inch TV to watch whatever on? Probably not. But do you want it? Sure. And if that, you know, satisfies you, then there's nothing wrong with that. But if you're going into debt and you're trying to impress somebody and the only reason you have it is so you can invite people over and be like, oh, hey, look at my 60-inch TV. For me, that's the wrong reason to do it.
But I think, if it's not putting you into debt and you're not, like, outrightly bragging about it, where does that I need a 60-inch TV feeling come from? Like, and I kind of think that it's planted into us. Like, the way we structure our kind of consumer-based society is we're told that that's what you do. You work to buy stuff, and that's it. And I just think that the paradigm of work hard for a company so you can buy something from another company, and it's just the money is just circulating.
Right.
You know, I kind of think that paradigm is just kind of broken. Like, it doesn't feel like I guess what I'm trying to say is, like, the consumerism materialism is, like, starting to just make itself more obvious to me, where it's like, well, why do you feel the need to have that brand of something?
Yeah.
Like, what is brand loyalty? That's crazy. Like, oh, I only buy Nike sweatpants. Why? That's a crazy thing to do. What is that? Why do you feel that allegiance? Like, what brainwashing have we all been through all our lives to be like, man, I just love BMWs. Yeah. Why do you love BMWs? What happened to you that made you like that?
So, I think it comes from what people measure to be successful, right?
Yeah.
And so the thing is if a society's measure of success is how much money you have and how much prestige and status you're trying to gain, and how much things you have so you can say that you have them, then that's like a sick outlook, right? So why are people trying to adjust to a society with a sick outlook? That's not healthy. So the thing is maybe changing what we value is probably the solution. And so maybe it comes from our nature to be competitive and to try to form a hierarchy. And it's true with guys more than it is with girls, right? Guys like to form a hierarchy. King of the hill, who's better, like, who lifts more, who has a better car, you know, who has, you know, who's taller, who's more well-developed, right? That's why we go back to the conversation of the bodybuilders or the old-school strongman, like, who can lift more?
Yeah.
The bragging rights. And I think the tribalism and nationalism and a lot of things that fall into that realm is just like, our team is better than your team. Our piece of dirt is better than your piece of dirt. My house is bigger than your house. My car is faster than your car. My TV is bigger than your TV. And that's where it comes from, like, that measure of success. It's an unhealthy societal outlook.
Yeah, and I think that natural competition, you know, that's... You know, a way to look at that is that every individual is striving towards something, right?
Right.
And I just think that what's happened is that instead of striving towards your own personal fulfillment, or like, and that's not to say happiness, because striving for happiness is the surefire way to not find any, but looking for the, not taking the easy road, but really finding something that you want to do and like kind of self-actualizing, like really doing what you want, is scary because you have to go out on a limb.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that the consumer kind of response is, it's like, well, maybe I can't write that book that I've always wanted, but I can have a bigger TV than Fred.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? And I think that it's that, you know, we have that drive as a species. I think all organisms have that drive, you know, like they want to survive and thrive. And somehow we have had this twisted into surviving and thriving is having an SUV and a pool. Like somehow that has been construed as what a meaningful life is.
Yeah.
And I think that one way to, you know, work around that is like, okay, well, what if I don't make comfort my first priority? What if I make experience my first priority? And not just looking for like, oh, I went to Bali and had a margarita on the beach, but like, no, I went and did something really hard and it was like a challenge and it was grueling and I learned so much and I know more of myself now. So like, where, how do we get those signals mixed where it was, you know, I mean, it's probably advertising, but
probably, yeah.
Marketing. Mixed with the Industrial Revolution where we, but like it just blows my mind sometimes where it's just like, man, like you ever see people like just, and just go, how do you think that's important?
Right.
Like people that just take themselves so seriously and they're like, just like touching up their car and like adjusting their like $2,000 jacket and saying, you know, what are you even getting out of this?
I think that there's present day, there's a lack of the ability to embrace discomfort, and comfort breeds discomfort. Right? Because if you don't do something that's uncomfortable, then you're going to suffer. Right? But a little bit of suffering and discomfort now will save you more, you know, it'll save you from suffering later because you'll be stronger. You'll be better able to endure it. And so that discomfort, I think people maybe use things to pacify that discomfort.
To distract
themselves. Yeah. So maybe it's just, People aren't willing to embrace uncertainty and discomfort, and you know it's driving our society to try to make things more fair, make things more comfortable. Like the lap of luxury and the idea of like having all these things around you is just a way to avoid discomfort.
And I mean, I think that, you know, that discomfort is kind of inherent in that, like, I think what we're trying to distract ourselves from at the end of the day is the thing that, you know, you could argue separates us from, you know, most animals, is we know we're mortal.
Right.
Yeah. So I think that, you know, if you're buying a boat to try to forget the fact you're going to die, you might be missing out on, you know, like if your whole focus is on accumulating stuff.
Right.
I don't know if you can really like live fully, because if it's like, oh, well, I just need to work 5 more years to buy this thing.
Right.
I just need to work 5 more years to do this thing. And I don't really like what I'm doing, but I just need the money so I can have the things that I want. And then I'll be happy. And I think that, you know, not taking that for granted is something that you can do to make yourself happier day to day.
Oh, well, maybe it's that, right? It's the and then.
Yeah.
That's what creates unhappiness. So you're not grateful for what you have. It's the, you know, instead of seeing what you have in front of you and being grateful for it, you're looking at all the things you don't have.
Yeah.
And then you're saying, well, if I had this, then, and then I would be happy. Or if I got this, you know, I would be happy. And then, you know, it's that additional, you know, what you have isn't good enough.
You know, yeah.
If I got a better job and I was making more money, and then I could buy this. Or, you know, if I had more, you know, whatever. And then, you know, it's maybe it's that. Like, you're not being grateful for what you have. There's just, like, a lack of your ability to see the things that you already have that are working out for you, that you do have, that you're, I'm not going to say blessed with, but that, you know, are...
I mean,
benefiting you.
If you're listening to this within the continental United States, you won the lottery for being born here.
Right.
And, you know, so, you know, looking at, I don't know, it's just so hard to, like, want to push out of that comfort zone, but I'm really trying to make it an effort that, you know, rather than accumulating things, I want to, like, the way I think of it is I want to accumulate experience.
Yeah,
you know, like, I want to interact with people in an honest way, and I want to, you know, go to competitions and travel and just even just reading and doing the podcast, just talking about things like that. That's more important to me. And that's not to say I don't cave in and occasionally say, oh, I really want that thing and get it.
Yeah, of course.
But, you know, trying to honestly evaluate, like, why do you want a new phone?
Yeah.
Like, why do you need the newest thing all the time? And I think, you know, it's distraction or competition, but I think no matter how you get there, it's not a healthy outlook, I don't think.
Yeah, I agree with that. You know, I think, and I kind of put this up on my Instagram and, like, my story. I said, I'd rather have a passport full of stamps than a house full of things. And I have the same outlook of, like, maybe my life should be focused more on experiences than getting more stuff. I think that now I've been more satisfied with my life, not working, like, a regular 9-to-5 job. It's been a little harder, but overall my level of satisfaction and contentment with my current existence is a lot higher than it used to be.
Yeah.
I don't make as much money, and, you know, sure, I don't really, you know, I don't want a boat or anything like that, and maybe that's part of it, is, like, I just lowered the amount of things that I want, and the experiences, and my ability to have more time doing the things that I want to do is much more valuable to me. I'm not trading my time for money anymore, necessarily. So I like the idea that you have of, like, I'd rather have more experiences than things.
And I think that's, we are coming up on, you know, the 1 year that we've been kind of starting up this gym. I think we leased our space next week, a year ago. And it has been just a crazy, crazy year. And like you were saying, it's not, you know, like, we both kind of gave up some, like, stability and comfort to do that, and we've both been working harder than we were before.
Yeah.
And things have definitely been tougher, but I'm so much happier.
Yeah.
because I'm doing what I want to do and what I choose to do.
Right.
And I think that, but I remember last year, I was just terrified.
Yeah.
Like, it was so scary to be like, okay, here's what I have. I know I can be comfortable and maintain this this path. but I'm just gonna do whatever I want. It's not comfortable,
right?
But it's gratifying, and I wouldn't trade it.
I definitely wouldn't trade it. My sister asked me a while back. She's like, if you could do anything that you wanted to do, like, what would you be doing? And I was like, well, I'd be doing what I'm doing now. I really wouldn't change anything.
Yeah.
I really wouldn't. And it's been a fantastic year that we've had since we opened the gym. And I look forward to continuing to work to make it better and continue to grow it and just live the life that we want to live the way we want to.
Yeah. So pursue challenge, not happiness.
Yeah.
And I think that you'll be happier struggling and accomplishing, or even struggling and failing, because it's not always going to be perfect.
It's not always going to work out.
And, you know, but the continual attempt to further what you're doing, I think, you know, and just stop buying a new phone every time it comes out. Just cut it out. You don't need it.
Yeah.
Like the camera's cool. You can measure stuff with it now, but you don't. No, just use it till it breaks. Come on, guys.
Okay.
Save some plastic. Those batteries are bad for the environment.
Yeah, I'm guilty of that, so I'll knock it off. All right, y'all. I think we'll end on that. Grayson, do you have anything else you want to add?
No. Just congratulations to Strength Academy weightlifting team member Consuelo Rios. She has made it to the American Open Finals at a meet this weekend. So we are now going to be bringing 5 people out to that meet, and it's going to be a blast.
Heck yeah. All right. Well, that's it for this episode, folks. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
All right. Take it easy, guys.
Happy lifting.